But right now, we're going to have a yarn about greenwashing. John Parbon, who's written a book, The Great Greenwashing, How Brands, Governments and Influencers Are Lying to You. G'day, John. How are you?
G'day. How are you going?
Good. You don't take things by half. What a Tell us about your background, because, of course, you live in the world of sustainability, don't you?
That's exactly right. I've been in the space, gosh, probably about 20 years now. But basically over that time, I saw a lot of academic discussions going on, which made me want to get out and explore things firsthand. So really out in factories and fields and in boardrooms as well, but trying to get a sense of, okay, how do I take all of this quite scientific and fluffy information and translate it in a way that people could understand and actually do stuff with.
Well, one of the things about this book, and one of the strengths of this book, of course, is the various places that you have actually entered. You started off your career after study at the UN, so that was a very interesting sort of inside look, wasn't it?
And it was always my career trajectory, was going to the UN, doing the UN. And after being there for several years and talking with lots of mentors that were there, they said, you know what, you might want a little bit of experience outside the UN as well, which is what I did. And I ended up in the private sector, but always working with big consultancies and helping them on their more, let's call it, altruistic side. So working with public sector clients, and then kind of fell into sustainability by accident, I suppose. It was before sustainability was even called that back then. I was living in New York. I had moved to Shanghai, and I had to figure out a way to marry all of that public sector experience in a very commercial city, and sustainability was the way to go, and the rest is sort of history.
Yeah, well, you know, we could go down that rabbit hole to talk about your experience of living in Shanghai. What a place to live. You actually do talk in the book, you actually use a variety of different examples, and one of them was about the construction site in Shanghai, where it's covered with a wall that talks about basically it's an art piece to greenwashing, really, isn't it?
That's exactly right. I remember that very distinctly. It was a massive mall that was going in, sort of a small residential complex that would have been one of the biggest buildings in the city, and it's a construction site. Construction sites are dirty. The building industry is quite dirty. I think it battles for number one dirtiest industry with agriculture, so it's way up there. But around the entire building site were these beautiful murals of, you know, pastoral lands and cows and flowers, and it boggles the mind that anybody would see the two things going on and go, oh yeah, I guess they're pretty green, but that's really hitting at the heart of greenwashing. It's these organizations painting a pretty picture, hoping you're not going to look behind the scenes.
You actually go through the various methods of greenwashing, like misdirection, seeding doubt, discrediting someone's reputation, and I really like the one, kill the chicken to scare the monkey.
It's my favorite Chinese idiom. They have lots of them, but that is the best one. So kill the chicken to scare the monkey is basically use someone as an example. And there are lots of these. The one I think that comes up in the book at length is the case of Steve Donziger, who's an American lawyer that's been fighting for decades against Texaco and Chevron for what they've done in South America. And he is that quintessential example. He's the chicken that Chevron is trying to kill, or has successfully, figuratively, killed. They haven't actually killed him yet, to scare anybody else away from taking up legal cases against this big oil company.
Yeah, it's absolutely egregious what happened there. But it's a very interesting case study, because we're talking about Ecuador and we're talking about Texaco having for, was it about a decade, dumping huge amounts of oil waste and polluting that country and causing massive illnesses, you know, just, you know, generational destruction. But because it was sold on to Chevron, Chevron has the temerity to say that there's nothing to see here. Chevron's never been in Ecuador.
That's exactly right. So they use those those nice little loopholes the corporations like so much to get out of having to pay back any restitution or do anything about it. And this has been a saga that's gone on now for close to 30 years, where Steve Donziger, the lawyer, this is his first case out of law school, and it's the only case he's ever had. What a case to pick. But because of all of this, and because of certainly a corrupt legal system as well, he has accomplished nothing. But in fact, he's become the victim in all of this, where he's been put under house arrest, he's been jailed, all to set an example so no other lawyers go after big corporations.
Yeah, it's an obscene story, in fact, but it's a good one that you've put into the book, I'll have to say, and it does point to the fact that people should read the whole book all the way through, because there's an awful lot of interesting stuff in your book. And you are trying to sort of look at the whole area, and you talk about the unsustainable. You divide it up into a whole range of areas, and one of them is the unsustainable industries. So we've got tobacco, oil, and defence.
That's right.
Because they kill people.
That's usually rule number one of sustainability, is you don't want to kill people. So because we like to look at sustainability as sort of the green part of it, and that gets the lion's share of the PR, but there's so many other things that are under this umbrella term as well, and one of those is primarily human rights, and, you know, the biggest human right is the right to live. So these companies that are in the unsustainable category are ones that kill their end user or kill people in general, and because of that, they will never be sustainable. You cannot be. It doesn't compute. So no matter what they do and what they say, they cannot be sustainable. But as I'm picking through this, I thought, okay, then there's those on the other end of the spectrum that aren't necessarily perfect, but are probably doing better than most. So those are things that are in highly regulated industries like technology, med tech, pharma. Again, not perfect, but better than most. But the majority of companies, they kind of sit in the middle. So they're doing good things, but they're also not perfect. They greenwash, but sometimes it's not intentional. So these are the ones that I like to focus on, because you can do something about that. The unsustainable, you can't do anything. They're sort of a lost cause, I hate to say. So let's focus on the ones where we can have the biggest bang for the buck.
Which is probably where your work sits, doesn't it? Because you actually do say in your book that you actually believe it's the private sector that's going to lead the charge. I mean,
that's right.
Yeah,
and that's just based on what I've seen and the work that they do. And at the end of the day, they got us in this mess in the first place. So
I was going to say,
but
it did occur to me.
That's it. There's other reasons too. I mean, if you look at kind of these big stakeholders, you have the private sector, the public sector, which is government, and individuals. We can talk about people power all we want, but there's only so much we can do because the problem is so big. But and governments certainly have washed their hands of trying for the most part. But corporations, they have a vested interest to do better because they know consumers are demanding it. But they also have access to capital and resources that those other two stakeholders could never imagine to have. These companies, some of them are bigger than countries. So it makes sense that we should be pushing them to be leading the charge and the change.
I mean, at this station, we would say that we could afford to have system change, but that's a perspective that you put forward, and it does seem like a pragmatic approach. There's other things that are interesting, the case studies that you go into, which I find really fascinating. When I heard that the next COP was going to be auspiced by the Saudi Arabians, I just thought, oh my God, this is really just an end game, isn't it?
It pains me to say, because, you know, this is my first paycheck was from the UN system, but it's become the foxes guarding the hen house. It doesn't make sense, and I understand they're trying to be inclusive and get everybody involved. I get that. But, I mean, optics are a huge part of this as well, and you can't have petrostates running conferences where we're talking primarily about oil and gas.
Well, that is the supreme misuse of a system, and it is the supreme kind of greenwashing, isn't it? I mean,
that's
it's the
exactly
same
right.
As the World Cup. being at the way that was handled. That was just the last World Cup. That was a disgrace, actually.
And the good part of it all is that people woke up to that, which is inspiring, I guess. So I don't know if the ends justify the means when it comes to human rights. But for the World Cup example, that is, people push back against that. Governments push back against that. So that's what we want to see. And hopefully we don't need to see too many more egregious examples where everybody starts to wake up.
Because sports events, I mean, I have to say that I stopped having any interest in the Olympics quite a long time ago. So it wasn't actually news to me what you say in your book about the way sports are used as a sort of a greenwashing affair, because what you're pointing out is that the public are aware that something needs to be done to have humans need to have a proper relational connection to the environment so that we don't destroy the planet. Like, the public know this as a general rule.
That's right. And there's this concept in sustainability, which I think people will pretty easily understand. We call it the social right to operate. And essentially what that is we don't, as consumers, just give money to a corporation to let them exist. We also have to give them a social reason to exist. We have to allow it. And corporations understand this. So how they greenwash through sports, is they'll use, like you mentioned, the World Cup, these big marquee events, to put their name against, or even the Australian Open is a great example. There was an amazing picture from, it would have been a few years back before COVID, where you have somebody, a major tennis star, on the court ready to take the final, and they're surrounded by these billboards of highly polluting industries, and you're just going, wait a minute. So essentially these corporations are using these marquee events to justify the things they're doing, or to throw you off the scent, to say, oh, look, we're good corporate citizens because we're supporting the sport that you all love. But again, just egregious examples of greenwashing. But on the positive side, we know we can work against that, because up until the 90s, tobacco was a major sponsor of sporting events, not just in Australia, but around the world. And we don't see that anymore because people push back. So hopefully in the not too distant future, we start to see people push back against the likes of automobile companies and oil companies sponsoring these major events as well.
That was interesting, that piece in your book about how the company that you were working for were approached by a tobacco firm to do an audit, because in your world there are actually whole structures and formats that are used to actually audit a company's sustainability. And a tobacco company came to you, your company, and it was an internal discussion in your place around if you could actually even deal with a tobacco company, because it can't compute, it can't be sustainable. But it was able to go to an English company, which I looked up, and is online and touts itself as, you know, an international company that is, reputable, da 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 da. But that company was able to basically greenwash this tobacco company quite happily.
These businesses will search around until they find somebody to validate what they're doing and put a stamp on it. We know they will. And you're right. In that example, it was a lengthy internal discussion, because our approach to any corporation was, if you come to us with the best of intentions, we will help you try to improve the things that you're doing. But with that, with tobacco, again, an industry that kills its end user, from a human rights perspective, we just could not, at the end of the day, help them. But like you said, they found somebody who did.
Yeah, who's still, considered to be a reputable company. International.
They're one of the big ones, yes. And, if people want to know the name, they can look.
You have
to
read the book. Yeah,
they're one of the big ones, yep.
Yeah. And then there's the, because it always reminds me of, if you, the artists who say that if you wear a suit, you can get away with anything.
This is true. Hopefully people are seeing behind that now too, but yes, usually with a suit, you can put a stamp of approval on much.
and I guess I mean, there's so much more in the book, but one of the last examples, because we're running out of time, is the very interesting observation around three countries and how they're represented in the world. So Australia, Singapore, and the European states. Each of these present themselves, or mainly people consider them in a favourable light, but if you actually delve down deeper, we've got a dark heart in when it comes to environmental sustainability. While on the other hand, you know, so Saudi Arabia is, completely, clearly have human rights problems as well as peddlers of oil, right? So, you know, some states get away with greenwashing their image.
That's right. And it's an interesting point of the discussion. I guess to frame it quickly, all countries are bad. We can say that. So the examples that are in the book are just the ones that, honestly, as an author, were easiest to write about, and I thought people would have the most interest in. But there's a great website called the Climate Action Tracker, and this group has monitored how well countries are performing against their 2015 Paris Agreement. And as of right now, there are exactly zero countries on track to meet their Paris Climate Agreement, which I think comes up in 2025, so in just 2 years' time. So no country is doing well. But in those examples, it's quite interesting, and since we're talking in Australia, let's talk Australia. People think Australia, they think clean, green. They get these images of the harbor in Sydney, and it's gorgeous. And yes, that's very true, and you can't find a more left-leaning place in the world where people are very much behind building a green, sustainable future. So that's good, but we have to remember at the heart of Australia, sort of out of sight and out of mind for a lot of us, is the heart of what finances this country, which is digging things out of the ground, which is highly polluting. So not to discredit all the amazing work that people and the government is doing, but there, like you said, I think you put it brilliantly, there is a dark heart to what keeps us afloat.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I mean, I'm old enough to remember as a teenager hearing on the radio, ABC radio, talking about in the 70s Australia being a great big hole in the ground. And I think, because there was is that all Australia is, a great big hole in the ground? And I'm thinking to myself, how much has changed? Nothing has changed. thank you very much for talking to us today, John. The book, The Great Greenwashing, How Brands, Governments and Influencers Are Lying to You, is out now, right?
That's exactly right. It's most bookstores and certainly online as well. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great discussion.
Yeah, thank you.